In the new book, The Dispensable Nation, American Foreign Policy in Retreat, former State Department advisor for Afghanistan and Pakistan and best-selling author Vali Nasr questions America's dangerous choice to engage less and matter less in the world while delivering a sharp indictment of America's flawed foreign policy. Nasr, according to the groundbreaking The Shiva Revival, worked closely with Hillary Clinton at the State Department of Afghanistan on Afghanistan and Pakistan affairs. In The Dispensable Nation, he takes us behind the scenes to show how Senator Clinton and her ally, Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, were thwarted in their efforts to guide an ambitious policy in South Asia and the Middle East. It's a pleasure to welcome Vali Nasr to the program. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
What brought you to this subject and to bring us behind the scenes and to tell us more of this story? And as you say in the subtitle of the book, this retreat of American foreign policy.
Well, I think generally in the past 4 years, we have adopted an attitude that foreign policy really doesn't matter. And the administration has tried to do less internationally and in particular has sent a signal that the United States really doesn't want to take a leadership role around the world, and that clearly the American public doesn't favor foreign military interventions, but even far short of that in terms of diplomatic engagement, economic engagement, bringing the world together around addressing critical issues. You know, in all of these, we have sent a signal that we really don't want to do these, and we much prefer the rest of the world just go about his business and for us to lead from behind if necessary. And I think those this attitude leaves us exposed in terms of protecting our interests. And I think it has it was very clearly evident during the Afghanistan-Pakistan conflict and is now very evident in our approach to Syria and developments in the Middle East as well.
You write at the very beginning of the book that you didn't want this to be a political bludgeon, and yet that is somewhat what it is, isn't it?
Well, not really, because it's really a statement about why foreign policy matters. I do fault the Obama administration for adopting an attitude that is premised on the notion that our leadership in the world doesn't matter and we really shouldn't be spending time on it. But I didn't want this book to be a campaign issue. And now that the campaign is over, there's 4 more years ahead of us. It's time to sort of go back and re-examine the assumption that we can really afford to be disengaged from the world and to withdraw from our leadership position, and to allow issues from North Korea to Syria to the Arab Spring to Afghanistan and Pakistan basically take their own course without us being playing a decisive role in resolving them.
One of the points that you make in the book, and there are several, but one of the main points that you make in the book is that this is an administration, in your opinion, that made it extremely difficult for its own foreign policy experts to be heard. Give us examples of where that was the case, of where these experts were really crying in the wilderness.
Well, I think largely the administration was interested in following domestic public opinion and domestic agenda, and therefore created a structure in the White House which would prevent really pushing for American engagement in the world. And a very obvious case was when the president was deciding what to do with Afghanistan in his first year in office. He decided that he really couldn't resist the military's push to export the Iraq strategy to Afghanistan. And the circle around him basically kept out of the discussion a diplomatic solution that was favored by Richard Holbrooke and the State Department that would have not required putting $100 billion a year troop surge into Afghanistan, which ultimately did not work, nor abandoning Afghanistan, but a path to a political settlement that would have given a sense of stability and regional engagement when we left that country. That was not on the table because the administration did not really want to do diplomacy. It followed a strategy for Afghanistan that came from its reading of domestic public opinion.
And yet in the book, both Richard Holbrooke and Hillary Clinton, in your eyes, get pretty high marks, don't they?
Well, largely because they stood for America's global leadership, They pushed for restoring the role of diplomacy in American foreign policy, of not leading with our military, which is an expensive value proposition and has not proven very successful in the past decade, but to go back to the tenets of American foreign policy that make America's leadership in the world indispensable and made it so important to global order, global prosperity, and security. And I think they were very important, and I think you can see the fingerprints of Hillary Clinton on every episode in the past 4 years where America had an assertive presence on the international order, places like Libya, like resolving a crisis with Pakistan last year. And I think for that, they get high marks. I fundamentally think part of the problem we're facing is that we define foreign policy as a total war, and short of that, we really don't want to engage at all. And I think that's the wrong way of posing the problem.
You paint a picture of rather large decisions, major foreign policy decisions, resting on the shoulders of White House advisors who you describe as really relatively inexperienced.
Well, that's exactly the case. I mean, take the case of the first year of the administration where he was making a decision as to whether or not to expand the war into Afghanistan, which was the president's single most important foreign policy issue in his first year. And ultimately, the decision as to what options the president would look at was taken by a group of relatively young advisors who came from the campaign to the White House and whose main point of reference was really domestic politics and the re-election of 2012. And that's why the strategies that were put before the president to choose from amongst were largely the ones that were driven by the domestic agenda. And these were not, you know, experienced foreign policy hands, diplomats, statesmen who had gone around the block a few times and had experience of how foreign policy ought to be done and what are the issues we ought to be concerned with.
One of the other stories that you tell in the book is about those who are sent out to sell various proposals to our allies in the Middle East. You make two points, one being just how obtuse those proposals would often be. And what I found to be fascinating is giving us a glimpse as to when it comes to those foreign policy professionals and world leaders, what they thought of them and their reaction to those proposals.
Well, I think one of the early indicators of why our foreign policy is not where it ought to be is the way it is received internationally. If when you go to tell foreign leaders, particularly those who are in a neighborhood where you are trying to implement your foreign policy, and they don't buy the wisdom of your arguments, and they don't believe you're going to have commitment to carry out your foreign policy, then you're in trouble. And when we went around the region and we went to world leaders and tried to tell them that we were really committed to a troop surge in Afghanistan and we were really committed to defeating the Taliban, we got a very clear pushback that nobody believed this, A, was a good idea to commit more troops for a total war with the Taliban, and B, they didn't believe that we would actually carry it through, that we would stand behind our own policy. And I think they were proven right on both counts, and they saw us basically abandon the fight. And that basically tarnishes our international standing and makes us much weaker when the next crisis comes around.
So where do you believe we are now? Has anything changed after the election? Because you talk about much of the concern of how this was going to play out in an election cycle, how this was going to play out on the nightly news. So has any of that changed upon re-election?
I don't think so. I think still the administration is not really engaged in foreign policy. It only is dragged into addressing it when there is a crisis and there's a hue and cry internationally about why we're not showing up. But it really has not addressed any of the fundamental issues that I raise in the book. It is still a very White House-centric process that is trying to protect the president from making clear decisions on foreign policy. The administration is not focused on foreign policy. It's not taking leadership on critical global issues like North Korea, like Syria, and basically the countries in those regions are left to try to figure out on their own, and therefore, you know, crises like those in Syria are festering to becoming a lot larger and more difficult to resolve.
So what global consequences do you believe that we should be prepared for as a result of these actions and these policies?
Well, first of all, if we continue on this path, we should expect that our influence will wane. If we're not leading, if we're not there, if we don't have clear strategies, if we don't stand behind our strategies, others will begin to factor us out. If we're signaling to the world that we really don't want engagement, we're not going to take leadership in Syria or North Korea, you know, countries like Syria, Iran, and North Korea are going to become far more aggressive because they assume that the United States is not engaged and will not be engaged. And thirdly, the problems that we are ignoring now are going to become bigger, and ultimately we will have to address them. Take the case of Syria. We've stood by the sidelines. We haven't done anything. Even today, the president said that only if they've used chemical weapons, we will get engaged. But Syria, at the same time, is turning into an al-Qaeda land. Large parts of it are now becoming failed state, dominated by al-Qaeda. That is not something we will be able to ignore in the long run. And so letting Syria go, not taking leadership, not rallying the neighborhood to address the problem, ultimately does not make the problem go away. The problem just becomes bigger and more expensive and more difficult to resolve.
And as we started talking about the book and what you write about, and of course your expertise within the administration of Afghanistan and Pakistan, but as you just noted with Syria and even North Korea, this is a global foreign policy that you believe is troubled.
Well, right. First of all, you know, how you act in one arena ultimately reflects on how you act in other arenas and how people assess your leadership and your commitment. So if you have a wayward strategy of surging 1 year in Afghanistan and withdrawing the next, then, you know, the assumption is that you're not going to stand behind your strategy. You dash in and you dash out. If you tell the whole world that you really don't want to take a leadership position and you're focused on issues at home, then they assume that you're not going to show up when a crisis happens, and therefore they have much more latitude to do what they want. And then, you know, the most important, I think, consequence is that these crises will reach a level where we will have to address them, but we will have to do so at a very high cost. We're really not saving anything.
How do you believe things would have been different if Richard Holbrooke and Hillary Clinton were left to their own devices?
I think they would have put before the president a very different set of proposals about how to conduct foreign policy, a diplomatic approach to resolving the Afghan crisis, a path to engaging the countries that went through the Arab Spring early on in order to more quickly bring stability and direction to what was unfolding there. A greater engagement diplomatically and also militarily in Syria early on so that the crisis would not spiral out of control to the extent that it has. And I think, you know, we cannot revisit those decisions, but I think it would have been important for the president to have those options before him and to have exercised them. It would have made for a very different outcome.
Is there a logical case to be made if you put aside cynicism and especially political cynicism? Is there a logical or at least viable case that can be made for the strategy that the president has employed over the last nearly 5 years?
Well, it is basically a strategy that is based on doing less internationally and not taking leadership on global issues and focusing on domestic agenda. It only works if nothing is happening around the world, and therefore you could afford to do less and focus somewhere else. But if you have a world in which crises are happening and there are major developments happening and we're not there to protect our own interest and we don't want to play the important role that we've played for decades, then that's not really a viable strategy.
So when it comes to how we are perceived by the rest of the world, what is this policy? What have these policies done to strengthen, either for good or bad, that portrait of this nation? And also, how then do you change it?
Well, what has now become very clear internationally is that the United States is retreating from the world arena. And it's not willing to get involved and take a leadership position. And I think that damages our global standing. We cannot simultaneously expect to be respected and be influential and not act and not exercise influence. This is a sort of a zero-sum choice here. And to address that is that we really have to have an assertive foreign policy. We have to assume a leadership role when it's due. We have to take a preemptive position on addressing crises. We have to go back to rallying the world community to arrive at consensus in addressing problems that are in front of them. And we cannot adopt a wait-and-see approach to foreign policy. We have to send a signal that we're not withdrawing, but rather we are engaged.
And you make the point in the book that the United States would not be comfortable with having, say, China pull the Middle East into a sphere of influence, or letting China manage al-Qaeda or Iran's nuclear ambition, or trying to resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict. So in that case, we want to have our cake and eat it too.
That's exactly right. I think the Americans do complain about foreign policy, but they're not comfortable with being irrelevant to foreign policy either. And they get enraged when problems around the world come and bite us at home. So we can have our cake and eat it too. And secondly, we've identified China as a global rival. If we begin withdrawing from the world, that vacuum ultimately will be filled by China. If we tell countries around the world that we really are no longer committed to their region or to their issues, they're going to begin to look elsewhere for that source of support. And these days, that mostly comes from Asia and China.
And a role once played by the Soviet Union.
Once played by the Soviet Union, whereas Soviet Union was actually aggressively looking for a role, the Chinese may not be looking for a role, but naturally their influence, particularly economic influence nowadays, will begin to fill the void that we are leaving behind. We don't know what the consequence of that would be, but before, you know, cavalierly deciding that we really don't need to protect our position in the world, we ought to think about its consequences.
When you consider foreign policy and this country's foreign policy and our history in that regard, was there ever a golden period when we got it right?
There are many successful episodes in American foreign policy, post-World War II, the Bosnia crisis. But there are also many other times when you don't have a clear success, but had the United States not acted, you would have had a much bigger disaster. So, you know, we have made many mistakes internationally, but we have been a stabilizing force. And this is not largely a charity to the world. This has actually protected our interests and facilitated our prosperity along the way.
And when you think of, as we wrap up, where does your optimism lie at this point over the next 3 years of this administration and future administrations?
Well, you know, I'm very optimistic about America's future. I think, you know, as we talk about the energy revolution, about American ingenuity and innovation, and also a gradual growth of American economy, I think the economic issues in America would ultimately go away, and we're on the rebound. The issue of that I'm raising in this book is really an issue of decision making at the highest levels of American government. It's not about a structural problem that the American economy has. It is that it's required that the United States government at its highest levels embrace the importance of foreign policy and importance of being engaged in the world and the fact that without American leadership, many crises around the world will not be resolved, and that will ultimately jeopardize our interests as well.
The name of the book is The Dispensable Nation, American Foreign Policy in Retreat. It is published by Doubleday. Vali Nasser, I thank you very much for spending time with us this morning. A delight to have your expertise.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you.
Again,
and to you. Again, the title of the book, The Dispensable Nation, is published by Doubleday. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.